Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
I've got another one for you if you want it, but carry on.
Who was on the plane?
So on Buddy Holly's plane, Big Bopper.
Yeah, and one Chantilly more. Lace. This is, I think it's Ricky Valance, Big Bopper, and Buddy Holly.
Yeah, Chantilly Lace. Oh, baby, that's what I like.
Right, that was better than the Inland Revenue chat. Anyway.
Yeah, because, you know, we'd all get arrested.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're discussing two English stars in the Champions League semi-finals. No, not Harry Kane and Jude Bellingham, but Eric Dier and Jadon Sancho. Speaking of people proving to be a surprising success, we'll also chat Kai Havertz and Kieran McKenna, and we'll nominate our favourite teams who didn't win the Premier League title. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have three men I admire most. Chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel. A former footballer who moved abroad to achieve glory with both Marseille and Nancy, it's Tony Cascarino. And another former footballer whose other initiation song he performed as a player was, in case you didn't get it from my little clue just then, the Don McLean classic American Pie. Gregor Robertson, come on then. How many of the 8 minutes did you actually perform when you did that song?
I think one.
One.
Yeah, that was enough for everyone.
And brilliantly, listeners, before the show, Gregor revealed that of the four of us here, he's the only one who doesn't actually know what that song's about. But you do now, Gregor.
I do, yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Billy Joel, apparently. Yeah.
Very good.
Very good. All the gags, but no more gags. We're going to talk about very...
Oh, go on then. Here we go. Okay. Very famous song, not by Don McLean, but about Don McLean.
Go on.
Can anyone tell that one? It's about Don McLean. Killing Me Softly is about Don McLean. It's about going to hear Don McLean, a very young Don McLean, perform Killing Me Softly with his song, Killing Me Softly. That's Roberta Flack going to see a very young Don McLean perform at a folk club somewhere.
There you go.
Thank you for listening to Martin Samuel's Music Hour. We've been there. Anyway, from Roberta Flack.
Also, Tony revealed earlier that he knows the song word for word.
Yeah, I think I probably do as well. And producer Neil says he does, but we're not going to sing it.
No, I'm definitely not going to do it.
You've never performed it yourself, despite knowing every word.
I've sung it. I sung it at karaoke in front of my family because, you know, when you get the words come up, I knew all the words anyway, and it's quite a popular song for many reasons with many families.
Bit of a showboat.
I've heard Tyson Fury sing it. Tyson Fury sung it after one of the fights against Deontay Wilder.
Yeah.
In the press conference room, in lieu of answering any questions, really, we decided to sing American Pie instead. And it being boxing is a sort of lunatic thing that happens, and everyone just applauds at the end of it. And, you know, you're left sort of rather sort of mystified.
I remember asking my mum what Levy was. You know, like...
Yeah,
I never knew what the Levy was. You know, I'm thinking... Yeah. It was like
it stops the floodwaters in New Orleans.
Should we go through the whole song? And
The levy part of it is really interesting. Yeah. I mean, that's why New Orleans with the floods and Hurricane Katrina and stuff like that. That's why it got cut off.
See, actually, I knew that. I didn't know about Billy Joel, but I knew that.
Stop making Billy Joel.
If you go to New Orleans, one or two of the things that people do in New Orleans is they visit the cemeteries, because the cemeteries in New Orleans are extraordinarily ornate, and because they've got a lot of tombs there, because people were entombed rather than buried, because if you bury below sea level, things tend to pop back up again, which is not really what you want. And and so they entomb, and they've got three presidents, huge tombs of presidents, in the cemeteries in New Orleans, including Andrew Jackson, the third president and one of the people that signed the declaration.
Well, there you go. Well, I mean, my Don McLean story.
If you want to talk about
football, I don't. Let's keep going. Let's keep talking about American Pie. I mean, it's good pals of mine, Grace and Max. It's Grace's family's favourite song. So when it came on at their wedding, big hoo ha. Everyone in a circle, and I, because I'm tall, I'm often the person who puts people on their shoulders. So the big kind of, I made the mistake of doing it at the start of that song, and let me tell you, it's a challenge for 8 minutes. One more thing about
American
Don McLean.
Pie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know the film.
Oh God.
Oh, the film. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? That was one of the questions in from a film, wasn't it? What was the filling of the pie?
Yeah. Oh God. Let's not talk about American Pie, the film. Anyway, I honestly...
Sorry, you have to cancel that.
I genuinely, sometimes with this show, especially on a Thursday, it's you two. You're like naughty little schoolboys, Martin and Tony.
It's Martin more than me. He knows way more than me.
I've made all that up.
Football.
Football. Football. Well done, Gregor. I was in the Matrix then. I didn't know where I was or what we're supposed to be talking about. Eric Dyer and Jaden Sancho, everybody. What a remarkable turnaround for them. Eric Dyer, the star for Bayern Munich. Well, star-ish. But he's certainly been doing very well. And Jaden Sancho getting all the plaudits for his performance in Borussia Dortmund's win against Paris Saint-Germain. So we wanted to talk about them and their kind of resurrecting of their careers. We also want to talk about it in relation to England. Tony, in terms of Eric Dyer, I wanted to know what you think of him as a player. Is this a case of Tottenham, you know, making a mistake and looking a bit silly, or is it just a case of a player finding a better fit for him at Bayern and under Thomas Tuchel than he would have done with under Postecoglou at Tottenham?
It's a really tough one to answer because I've always believed... You know, I know you're going to talk about Sancho afterwards, but the confidence thing was the biggest difference for me. When I played and I went abroad, I found my confidence probably back to where I was at Millwall, where I just felt confident inside. The coach was for me. The team accepted me really quickly. There was no battles going on within the dressing room, whether I should play or not. Eric Dyer's gone to Bayern. Tuchel obviously played some part. I wouldn't even be surprised if Harry Kane's played a part to, you know, say, he'll do a job for us. Yeah, because players do talk to clubs. You know, they go back to their club and say, by the way, he's really solid or whatever, what you need. I just think he's fitted in, not initially, he's not been outstanding, but he's slow burner as the season's gone on. And if you look last night's game, you know, the lad alongside him, Kim, was struggling and Dyer looked really comfortable. And I don't know, it feels like it's home there already for him. It's a big thing. I felt like within 6 weeks of Marseille, I was at home. I felt like it was the club I should be at right at that time.
Because he's gone late in his career, and obviously France came late in your career as well. Do you think that has an effect in kind of rejuvenating a player? A complete change of scene when you've been in the same league for a long time?
Well, I was slightly different. I felt my door was closing of my career at 31. And I felt I got a last chance saloon scenario come to me. And I felt that's what Dyer's had.
Yeah.
A last chance saloon. Now, he would have found a club, but I mean as in a big club. You know, I was at Chelsea. When I was in World Cup 94, I had a fax come through from Blackpool, Notts County. There was three clubs. It was the third one. I spoke to Charlton. And I'm thinking I'm going from Chelsea to...
Going from the World Cup as well.
Well, Blackpool were in the second division at that time. You know, so I'd gone from that scenario. Eric Dyer was never going to be doing that. But if you've played for big clubs, and he's obviously... Tottenham are a big club. And then you're getting the opportunity to go to Bayern Munich, which is a huge club in comparison with European success. You know, winning leagues year by year in the Bundesliga comfortably. And someone at that club thinks you're a good option for that club.
We've spoken a lot about this season, even like, oh, it's a different scenario, but like having the confidence to sort of take control of your own career.
Yeah.
That's another thing. It's, you know, someone like Harry Maguire was spoken a lot about earlier in the season. I was like, why is he not moving on? West Ham came from, why? You know, he's got to play football if he wants to play in Euros. I mean, he's been vindicated by saying, no, I'm going to stay and fight for my place. And he got the opportunity. It's the same for Dyer. I mean, I think Fulham came in for Dyer. You know, that was the level of the club in the Premier League that was going to show him a, you know, give him a chance. And he thought, no, I'm going to take control, even if it means sitting my backside for a few months on a free. I think there'll be a better opportunity. And he's shown that he's still capable of playing at the highest level.
Martin, what do you think of Eric Dier? Because he's a player that's played lots of different positions and lots of different types of defences, mm-hmm. back threes, back fours. And he has at times played an absolutely pivotal role for England in previous tournaments, of course. Mm-hmm. How do you look at him now as a player, 30, with the Euros approaching?
Well, I look at players sometimes and think in terms of managers that like them, basically. And you look at the managers that have found, you know, the managers that Dier have found favour with, they're good managers.
Mm.
Pochettino liked him. When Jose Mourinho went to Tottenham, he was crucial for Jose Mourinho at first.
Mm.
And Mourinho's a good judge of players and does well with players. And Southgate relied on him. And you think of his role in 2018 where he takes the anchor penalty, and I can remember what everyone thought as it was Eric Dier walking towards the penalty spot, and everyone was thinking, oh, no, dude, what are we doing? What, this, you know, the centre half, really? And it was a solid penalty. It was a successful penalty shootout for England, and we haven't had that many of them. But that was all to do with psychological evaluation and things like that. And Southgate saw something in it. And Thomas Tuchel, who all the world over has won the Champions League in very unlikely circumstances with Chelsea, and may do so again with Bayern Munich, who knows, he likes him.
Would you have him in? Sorry, go ahead.
See, Antonio Conte did as well. I think I saw in a recent interview he said he thinks he played his best football for Spurs under Conte.
Yeah.
I've also got to remember that the manager that replaced him plays such an extreme form of football where centre-halves are required to be ridiculous athletes that he was just a man out of, you know, position and time. So, you know, he still had a lot to offer, and he's shown that at Bayern now.
Yeah.
Would you have him in an England squad, Martin?
Well, we've got 26 players now, so he hasn't featured in any England squad that I've made myself so far on paper, but he might do. You look at it now and think, okay, now you've got another three players to play with. Mm. Would he be one of those guys?
Maybe
because
in the
experience. Because he can step into midfield.
Because a lot of the people
experience,
we're talking...
Experience, he can step into midfield.
A lot of the people we're talking about as the kind of backups haven't got much experience at all, whereas you're bringing in someone who has played at major tournaments and does have that experience. So.
And as Martin said, scored a winning penalty in a penalty shootout.
Indeed. I think he could still force his way in, yeah.
Tony, did you have him in?
I made the pin on injuries.
No, not really, but but then you could go, well, how is John Stones going to be? Because John Stones is sort of getting to the stage where he's a little bit like Varane, where he keeps getting injured and missing a lot of football. So if you're, you know, there's always four or five injuries before tournaments, and if it's a couple of defenders, then you can make a case for Eric Dier getting in. But if you said initial 23 and it may go to 26, I think he's got an outside chance.
Mm.
But he's going to have to play really well in the remaining games. And if Gareth, like we said, we've all mentioned here, managers like him, a particular player. If Gareth thinks, well, Eric's, you know, I'd need someone like Eric to come in. Mm. It's, again, it's a manager that's choosing a player over someone, you know, that he feels more confident in.
And these glimpses we're getting of him, and they are glimpses because, you know, we can all pretend how sophisticated everyone is and that we're across everything in Europe, but the reality of it is you're not, very few people are across European football as much as they're across what's happening in our leagues. So you do find yourself tuning in when there's a big European match and someone gets drawn against an English team or the, you know. So the point I'm making is Tomori of AC Milan, and everyone was going, oh, you know, look at where AC
Chris
Milan
Smalling,
in the league.
What he's done.
He's got to be in. He's got to be in. And then they play Chelsea, that home and away, and you watched it, and you're thinking, oh, right, okay, yeah, well, that's not an England. That's not an England centre half we're watching here. So in those two matches, that sort of put him back in the eyes of. Whereas Eric Dier when you see him in the, in a couple of games against Arsenal and now this one against Real Madrid, you've seen him and you're pleasantly surprised. You're thinking, oh, actually, yeah, no, he looks good in this Bayern Munich team. He doesn't look bad at all. Mm. You know, so that must help as well. Because I don't think Gareth Southgate was in Munich. I certainly didn't see, they certainly didn't focus in. On the crowd, you know, certainly not as much as they kept focusing on these 20-something young girls that they kept finding every single time, you know, every single time that there was a break in play, you know, you'd think the entire stadium was populated by like Girls Aloud or whatever, you know, but
so the musical reference, very good.
Another one, we're just shoehorning them in today, but. Yeah, but you look and think, right, so this looks good, this is positive. And if Gareth Southgate's watching that at home on television, he's probably thinking the same thing.
Yeah, that debate around whether we are just cherry-picking little moments from these glimpses, because as you say, we're not watching them, does lead me nicely on to talk about Jadon Sancho, a player that has, you know, perhaps embodies that modern phenomena of glimpses, social media highlights reels, step over here, top corner finish there. And then perhaps when we saw him, he didn't perhaps live up to that billing. Tony, I'm going to start again with you, and I wanted to separate these two players out because as much as they are, it's very different stories. Is this similar to Dier and you? Is he gone back to somewhere, you know, and is he found comfort in it? Or is it completely different in that, you know, he's gone back to a team where he's played before?
Yeah, he's going back to a club where the fans loved him.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's the first port of call. That's a big benefit to him. I find it really strange because a lot of people, when he came to Manchester and he was playing the way he was, a lot of people would go, well, the club's just too big. It's a bigger club than Dortmund. Well, there's 81,000 in the stadium last night. And it didn't look like he'd gone into a shell in any shape or form. In fact, he was doing everything. The reason why they paid 70-odd million for him.
Yeah.
He was getting to the byline. The fullback didn't win a stick or twist with him. Mm. And it was like every Man United fan would be like, wow. We never saw that. If we got a glimpse of it, that was it at Old Trafford. We didn't see it often enough. The word confidence has changed a lot for me because I used to think, do you really change that much? And I, after experience being really confident and knowing you're doing the right things and the game's easier for you and you've got a big smile on your face, it's way different from getting stick. Not, you know, fullbacks getting to you, nicking the ball off you, then getting one of the biggest things I think affect players, and this happened to Jadon Sancho a lot, is when you keep getting subbed.
Yeah.
So you're playing a game, you think you're doing all right, and then suddenly you give a ball away, it's 61 minutes, and you think, oh, my number's going to be up. And suddenly your number's up, you're walking off, you're shaking hand. He's doing that way too often. There wasn't anybody that say, leave him on, let's try and get him through this bad patch and keep saying, we're going with you. I know people go, well, you can't keep doing it, but I felt at times he's got the substitute scenario where he either knows he's coming on or going on or coming off.
Yeah.
And that's where Antony is now.
Yeah.
You know, that's where Martial was. Mm. So they've had a number of them type of wingers, and especially being a young man, you know, how much did the Euros affect him as well? Mm. His mindset at that time, it might have been a long course to get back to where he is now. Fallout with Ten Hag. I just think going back to a club was probably the best decision he could have made with him and his whoever's looking after him, where he was loved.
Yeah.
And if it takes being loved, then why wasn't he loved as much at Man United? I'd ask that question.
He's not the first player who's kind of been sucked into the vortex that is Old Trafford, though.
No.
You know, a talent drain. So you know, always said all along, clearly there's been issues between him and the manager, but the blame for his kind of drop off in form and performance would never just lie with him entirely. And the psychology of it is always fascinating. Like, as you say, he's just kind of liberated by going back to a place where he knows he's loved, and as the club account even tweeted afterwards, like, appreciated and valued. We're seeing things. We saw things last night that, like, you just never ever saw. Even the fact
getting to the byline.
There was that, but there was also times where he was coming inside and playing in that, like, almost like the little pocket, the little number 10 pocket, that little through ball he did for was it Julian Brandt when he came on? I think.
Yeah.
Little nutmeg, like beautiful little touches like that, and the kind of creative things from inside, just not just a Tyro winger. Like, we saw various aspects of his game that were just were just completely absent at Manchester United. So, well, as I say, the psychology of these things always fascinates me. It's just what it takes for you to be, as I say, kind of liberated and for your confidence to change so dramatically in the space of a few months.
Martin, in terms of Sancho, you know, there is an impressive element to it of where the fallout with Ten Hag meant that the last time he played for Manchester United was the 26th of August. Mm. He then didn't play any football until the 13th of January when he played for Dortmund and has since gone on a long run of playing. Mm. That perhaps, for lots of the comments that may be made about his time at Manchester United, about his attitude and things like that, that perhaps does suggest that, you know, as Tony said, he needs a bit of confidence and a bit of belief in him and he'll show you what he can do.
Yeah, there's a player there. You know, that is in many ways the difference with his situation and Eric Dyer's situation, that people didn't really think that Eric Dyer had it by the time he left Tottenham, couldn't get in the team, and people regarded him as, oh, well, he's time to move on. As Gregor said, you know, Fulham came in for him, but whereas I think people have always known that there's a player in Jadon Sancho. Pep Guardiola didn't want him to leave Manchester City. You know, it's a myth that Guardiola had him out of City. That was Jadon Sancho who wanted to go because he didn't think he was going to get enough opportunities. And Pep Guardiola was desperate for him to stay because he thought that there would be opportunities there. He thought there would be a pathway there. And he thought he was a player that could make his first team at Manchester City. It wasn't the same with Cole Palmer, undoubtedly. I'm not saying it was a mistake because, you know, you look at what Man City have got at their disposal and, you know, Cole Palmer wouldn't have got the same opportunities he's got at Chelsea. But Guardiola was happy for Cole Palmer to go. He was happy to sanction that deal. He didn't want Sancho to go. Mm. So there's a player there and I do wonder, when you look at what the fallout was at Manchester United, you do. I'm all for backing the manager and everything, and Sancho wouldn't apologise, and that was. You just look at how many directors of football they've got, and this one, and that one, and you think, what, no one there can broker this situation? Mm. Nobody there was capable of fixing this impasse between the player and the manager, when they've paid so much money for this kid and there is such a talent there. It seems very, very strange. I mean, at one stage, I wanted to sell him to Saudi Arabia. Mm. Mm. You know, and that deal fell apart or didn't go anywhere because the Saudi club wanted it as a loan deal and Manchester United were insisting on it as a sale. Mm. So, you know, that's a fallout. That is a proper no way back scenario.
Would we all think that the dressing room would have some part to play as well? As in, you know, there's a lot of players who are underachieved at Man United. You know, and that comes from the coaching. I think there's a lot of points to this argument about Sancho because I just look at a dressing room and I look at all the players and there's a lot of players who underperform in that dressing room. Mm. And it became a bit of a habit for everybody. Mm. You know, you have dressing rooms that everyone's overachieving. Mm. Even the guys that come in play well because the standard is set at the football club. So this is it. You get in the team, you've got to play well. You've got to do the right things. I don't think, if you look at Man United and you look at a number of their players, so many of them have underperformed. And he was one of them and probably took most of the hits. I don't understand. I've never seen a player change so much of being so poor when I last saw him and see him for Dortmund and watching him last night. I was laughing to myself and thinking, how can you ever judge a player when you're watching this lad do? If you were watching him for the first time, you'd be going, he's English, he's 100 million already. Wouldn't you? You'd look at him and that's how I'm watching the game. I'm watching him skip. I'm looking at the fullback thinking, he's having a nightmare. He's probably going to say, he's the hardest winger I've ever had to play against. Yeah, well, no.
You lot drive us all mad in the press box because you'll do one thing for 80 minutes, you'll get a nice report written, you've got it all set up, and then you do something totally different in the last 10 minutes and destroy everything.
It would have been easy last night, Mark.
Yeah,
he played well all the game, and I just found it very hard. It's confusing. It's confusing to listen And I think of Ten Hag's role, and I think of the coaches, and wasn't there anybody that could sort of find some sort of scenario that he played best football? I just really have no idea how that all came about.
Well, there's so many things that happen at Manchester United that you think, what, there was nobody there that could have sorted this out? You're going all the way back to pre-Glazer takeover and what sort of, and what, you know, what caused it, and the row about the racehorse and the rocket. And
remember, thinking, we've only got 40 minutes left on
this
show.
I know, we've only got 40 minutes, yeah. I'm not going to do the brief history of Manchester United, but what I mean is,
be longer
you're going
American
all
apart.
The way back to that, and you think, there was no one at the club that when Alex Ferguson said, I'm going to sue our major shareholders over a racehorse, nobody went, no, Alex, you're not going to do that. No, that's going to cause us no end of trouble. And you know, since, you know, because of what happens there, you end up with the Glazers. And you think, what, and there was no one at the club? I mean, David Gill, everyone says, well, the genius chief executive and stuff. What, and David couldn't have got in the middle of
this,
that?
This sounds a little bit like one of those kind of A-level essays where you say, like, start with J.P. McManus and Sir Alex Ferguson, yeah, and end at Jadon Sancho.
But no,
and
what
how,
I mean
what,
is...
What comes in between?
What comes in between is a lot... But
mismanagement.
But that's... Yeah. Not even mismanagement. But you just think... There's been a load of people have passed through that club with a lot of responsibility that haven't taken, you know, and that's a massive one. The manager versus the major shareholders is a massive one. But this is quite a minor one. Mm. This is a staff dispute that surely someone could have got to the bottom of.
It's certainly something Manchester United will have to and want to resolve in the summer. I'm going to ask the same question, but I'm assuming this is a very quick answer given all the attacking talent that England have.
Surprised.
Jadon Sancho doesn't make the England squad, does he, for the summer?
Once you've got 26, you know, look, probably not, but once you've got 20, because we've got a lot of those forward players, wide players, well, you know, we've got so many good forward players, you know, we're trying to work out how we can get them all in the team, all in the squad, let alone the team. But so possibly not, but at the same time, once you've got 26, that 23 to 26 jump, that extra three...
Could be Eric Dier and Jadon Sancho.
Well, it suddenly all bets are off. Suddenly people that you're thinking, no, he's got no chance. You're suddenly going, oh, has he, you know.
Tony?
I don't think Gareth has selected him.
No.
Imagine if he lifts the Champions League and gets a great goal and everyone in Europe is saying, has he left out of the England team?
Could be. Gregor?
No, there's too much competition, I think, for that spot.
But maybe in the future.
Absolutely.
Maybe for the World Cup. For the World Cup. Now, moving on from Eric Dier and Jadon Sancho to another player who has moved from one club to another and we are suddenly deciding is actually quite good. Kai Havertz, who was the subject of one of the items in your column this week, Martin. But it comes back to that idea of a slight refitting of how we think of a player once they move clubs and then what that means for that club itself. Tell us a little bit more on your view on Havertz, Chelsea and Arsenal.
Kai Havertz now becomes another one of these players that Chelsea have messed up. Chelsea have lost. What a mistake. This was ridiculous what Chelsea did. How can they sell Kai Havertz to Arsenal, their great rivals? And you're thinking, yeah, but it was only last summer, so we can all remember last summer. And nobody was saying that at the time. You know, there was nobody was saying that Chelsea were the mugs in this. Everyone was almost looking at the perspective, what are Arsenal doing? Why are they spending 60 million quid on this player? We've seen him for three seasons, etc. Now, I've always thought Kai Havertz was a good player. I once wrote, and I'm not saying it's been proven right.
You're saying it now.
No. Mate, you know, when I write these things, I don't actually check what I've previously written.
Do you?
Make sure. Yeah, absolutely I do. To make sure that no one can go, yeah, but you said this about Kai Havertz last summer. And I did check, and the one thing that I said is, if they're going to drop 12 million quid in it, well, that seems about right. And as it turned out, they only dropped a couple of million quid. But I did write in his very first season over it, I thought he was a future footballer of the year. And it hasn't worked out like that. And after his third season at Chelsea, no one was thinking he was a future footballer of the year, including me. But it does make me laugh because there's two or three of these guys at Chelsea now. And everyone sort of retrofits, to use the word of the moment, everyone sort of retrofits them now into when they were at Chelsea, like Kevin De Bruyne and Mo Salah. And everyone, oh, what ridiculous, how can they get rid of them? But Kevin De Bruyne and Mo Salah weren't playing like they have played in the last 5 years when they were at Chelsea. Jose Mourinho's not an idiot. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he wouldn't have got Kevin De Bruyne in his last few seasons and gone, oh, well, we're going to sell him to Wolfsburg for, you know, a set of spanners. You know, it's... and so Kai Havertz joins this list, but in none of those, with none of those guys, they weren't actually performing for Chelsea as they have done at their peak at Man City, peak at Liverpool.
People, I suppose, they'll say they might need the opportunity, though.
Yeah, but that, if you remember, Kevin De Bruyne started that season. He played two of the first three games for Mourinho in that first season and didn't do that great. Now, three games isn't very much, but it was a very competitive Chelsea team at that time. People forget that as well. Like, you go, well, okay, so who are you going to put him in ahead of? Eden Hazard, Cesc Fabregas, or Willian? Which one of those were you going to drop? And, you know, it was a really competitive Chelsea team. Kai Havertz actually scores the winning goal in a Champions League final, for God's sake. You know, there's always a player there.
Yeah.
But it looked like he'd had too many managers. He'd never found his right position. He couldn't quite finish and everything. He'd been fabulous for us.
Yeah. I guess it comes back slightly to Gregor's point that you made about Eric Dier, of where, you know, it's not necessarily that Postecoglou's an idiot for getting rid of a really good centre-back. It's just that he doesn't fit his system. Tony, firstly, what do you think of Havertz as a player in relation to some of the things Martin said, you know, as a forward? And then, secondly, do you think it is, coming back to some of the themes that we've talked about in this first half hour, that idea of confidence and just fitting a bit better with Arteta and Arsenal?
Well, Chelsea fans weren't, you know, moaning or complaining on the radio at all, as Martin said. They're, you know, it's a tough one because I always found him one of them players that it's hard to pigeonhole him in a position. And I think he's very versatile.
Played a wing back for Chelsea. Yeah, well, for Germany, actually. Played a wing back.
Well, I don't ever think, yeah, he's going to be that sort of centre forward role. Then will he play the 10? Well, not quite sure about the 10. Will he play out wide? I've always felt that about him. But you have to say he's technically very gifted. I think he's reliable. He's a moments player, which every now and again reminds you how good he can be. I think he's improved over the course of the season. I thought what we saw in the early months at Arsenal was the Chelsea player that the Chelsea fans witnessed. What's happened in recent weeks is that he's just come up a level. And by the way, the big smile on the face when getting goals as well. You know, it happens a lot to sportsmen. When the game and you're doing well and you nip, you know, goals. And again, he wasn't getting substituted in the previous games because Arteta was leaving him on.
He scores one goal for Arsenal. This is the thing. Even until not long before Christmas, really, people are still questioning Arsenal's wisdom in buying Kai Havertz. He's got one goal before they play Brentford on November the 25th. He scores the third against Bournemouth in a 4-0 win from the penalty spot. Penalty.
So he hasn't which was given to him, I think, by Ødegaard to try and get his confidence.
To try and get his confidence up. Yeah. You know, so he hasn't scored from open play until November the 25th against Brentford.
We can definitely agree that, you know, in recent weeks there is a fresher, more content.
If Arsenal were to win the title, which is not beyond the realms of possibility, if Arsenal were to win the title, this will be seen as one of the great coups of the season. One of the great turning points of the season will be Arteta's acquisition of Kai Havertz and turning.
They've
him
even
into,
got a song about him now, haven't they?
Yeah.
You know, they've even got their own song, Arsenal fans.
Got on, was
got it? Do you know every word of that one?
American Pies at my chance.
I'd like to think that over the course of the season, you've seen the benefit of really top coaching that's come out of Arsenal to make him a more complete player.
Yeah. But I think also the way the kind of team shape's evolved as well. I think some, you know, it was a question whether he's like the advanced number 8 in midfield earlier in the season and then whether he could play up front. And I think even Odegaard's role has changed a little bit. He's kind of played a little bit deeper. And that allowed him to either play a bit further in advance. And then, I don't know, as the team kind of started to find its feet and its rhythm, he could even be the striker. So I think it's also about Arsenal's development through the year. I think you could say the same about Odegaard. You know, earlier in the season we were saying, where is he? And now he's like,
it goes back to
the season's a bit long, he'd be player of the year.
Yeah, it goes back to my point about, you know, when we talk about Manchester United and Sancho and not players improving, you're seeing that Arsenal, that players are improving. I think Ben White's a far better player.
Yes.
Than what he was when he first signed for Arsenal. And I would say that Saliba's improved. I think he's a better centre-half, and I think that's happened across the board in many different positions.
Ben White is quite possibly the form right-back in the country.
Yeah, he's playing really well.
Yeah, you good know. Coaching, works in football.
Yeah,
it'll never
absolutely.
Catch on.
Who would have thought it?
Who would have thought it? Well, listeners, if you've got views on whether Eric Dier or Jadon Sancho should make the England squad, or perhaps you want to petition for us for a spin-off music show, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, stick with us. We're talking about Ipswich, Liverpool and title winners next.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and today I'm joined by Tony Cascarino, Martin Samuel and Gregor Robertson. And Gregor, you're going to tell us about the really, really significant win that happened in midweek. And it wasn't the Champions League. It was in the Championship, wasn't it?
It was. It was Ipswich Town getting the 3 points that puts them within touching distance of back-to-back promotions and return to the Premier League for the first time in over 20 years. Mm. This is like one of the stories of the season. Yeah. Absolutely. Across the board. I think they'll be, if they do it, they need a point against Huddersfield, who are already relegated because of their goal difference. There's only Watford, Norwich and Southampton have done this since in the Premier League era. And it's all been the job of Kieran McKenna, the inspirational 37-year-old super coach, I think you could call him, because the transformation was remarkable. He took over in December 2021 when the team were languishing kind of mid-table in League One. And I think they won 7 of the first 10 games. His impact was immediate. And there's still a real core of the same group of players. Like, they've spent less than £5 million since he took the job. And you look at the teams they're going up against with parachute payments in Leeds United, Southampton, Leicester, and they've been going toe-to-toe with Leicester the whole season. A couple of wobbles. Even the last few weeks, they've been getting draws, but others have, like Leeds, you know, fallen apart, getting hammered 4-0 by QPR. But this was a tough task. You know, we saw Coventry in the semi-final against Manchester United. They'd just fallen off their opportunity of reaching the playoffs, but still a really tough place to go, and they ground out the win. And it's just a remarkable story. They got 98 points and 101 goals in League One last season, and they've already got 93 points and 90 goals this season. They've outscored the whole league, as I say, as a team have just come up from League One. And you look at the squad, and someone like Leif Davis, who they signed in League One, left back, who's got 18 assists
You're picking out a left back.
He is, but he is one of their most creative players. Mm.
He's extraordinary. He's an excellent player. Yeah.
Some of the passes you see him play, you know, if you watch the highlights, and he just collects the ball like in a sort of little inside channel and inside his own half, and just arcs a beautiful pass in behind the opposition's defence for someone to run onto. Mm. Goal. His set piece delivery. All this sort of stuff. So many players who've stepped up and flourished. Wes Burns, who came from Fleetwood. Mm. He's just looked outstanding in the championship, and then the odd kind of loan, Omari Hutchinson, who's on loan from Chelsea, who scored an absolute worldie last week as well, and he's kind of taken a bit of time to get into the team, but he's been outstanding in the second half of the season. Lots of players you could go through. Kiefer Moore, who they signed in January, kind of on deadline day, scored 7 goals since signing, then really important ones, but it's all about. When you watch them, it's all about the coaching and the team.
I was
going to
say, it is all about McKenna,
isn't
it? It's
about the team.
Yeah, and what he's done there, shockingly. Another person who was at Manchester United and not necessarily well thought of, and turns out he's quite good, Martin. but in terms of Kieran McKenna, this is a heading into a summer of potential managerial merry-go-rounds of clubs taking managers from here and there.
Ipswich fans already wanting to rip their ears off.
Absolutely.
Saying we're a point away from the Premier League and you're trying to steal our manager.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to suggest that he's done a very good job and that football's a cruel business and that people poach the best talent.
Yeah. I saw the names connected with West Ham. If I was West Ham, I'd be looking at Kieran McKenna. If I was Manchester United, without making everything about Manchester United, I would be looking at Kieran McKenna, who knows the club. And there are already reports that if Brighton were to lose Roberto De Zerbi, that the guy that they have earmarked as his replacement is Kieran McKenna. And you think, well, that seems a smart move, and Brighton are a smart club. And so that seems exactly the sort of thing that Tony Bloom and Brighton would be looking at. You know, that you've got a drawer somewhere in your office that says, if we lose the manager, this is the phone call we make. If we lose the chief executive, this is the phone call we make. Every football club should have that drawer. And every good company should have that drawer. And that makes sense. Kieran McKenna, you know, please, you know, ideally, Kieran McKenna stays at Ipswich Town and succeeds with them in the Premier League. I genuinely mean that. But we have to, you know, football is, we've got to be real about the way football works. There will be clubs looking at Kieran McKenna and thinking, this guy should be our next manager. What I don't understand is why one of them is not Manchester United.
Gregor?
One thing I would say is that Ipswich, as a club as well, have been transformed in the time that he's, you know, since 2021, basically. They were bought for 40 million, a takeover from Marcus Evans, who'd kind of had been a real, really tough slog under him for a long, long time. And then just in March gone, they sold 40% of the club to a US private equity firm for 105 million. So in the space of those 3 years, the club's valuation has climbed from 40 to 260 million, if you work out on that basis. Mm. And they've got a brand new training ground on the way. They're selling out every single week, which is a club it's got the stadium to be a Premier League club. Mm. They have this money behind them now. They're smart, and the recruitment's been excellent. There's a lot of reasons for him to stay and to develop this club further.
Absolutely. And particularly, and let's hope he does.
Particularly, let's also say this is his first job.
Yes, it is his first full-time job.
He's been a coach
for
a long, long time. He had to retire through injury. He was a Tottenham...
15 years he's been a coach, hasn't he?
Tottenham youth player, yeah. 15 years, you're right. He was 22 when he retired. And he's been a coach in Spurs youth team. Went to Manchester United initially in the 18s. Jose Mourinho spotted something in him, brought him onto the staff, worked under Solskjaer and Ranić before getting this job. So this is his first job. I think it'd be a big thing for him to step away from this, and particularly after achieving back-to-back promotions.
Very interesting. We will see what the future holds for Ipswich and Kieran McKenna. And of course, we wish them luck in sealing promotion this weekend. Now, another team, slightly different circumstances, but looking for a new manager, we think they might have found one, is Liverpool. But I wanted to talk about them in relation to what's happened in the last few weeks. because we've got Tony Cascarino here, the prophet who foresaw this slight demise and dip in form and performance on the pitch. But also, Martin Samuel, you wrote your Monday column on the website, which was headlined, Klopp's exit has not been mishandled. He did his best, and so did Liverpool. As the theme of the first part of the show was mentioning retrofitting, do you feel there's a bit of retrofitting going on with just, Liverpool this season?
It was just a little bit of a degree of sympathy for both him and for the club, because I think that they both tried to do their absolute best for each other in many ways. That Klopp, there's a number of points in this, but that Klopp, once he knew he was leaving and he told the club before Christmas, and it was going to leak, and I think I could understand why the club announced it when they did, or why they allowed Klopp to announce it when he did. But equally, I can understand why Klopp didn't leave it until the end of the season. Because I think he was trying to do right by them. That he knew he'd made this decision. He wanted to give them time to find a replacement. He could have dropped it on them. We could all be sitting here talking about Liverpool just going off the boil and you know, but they'll go on to next season, and Jurgen Klopp sitting there with a letter of resignation in his drawer, ready to give it to him 10 minutes after the Wolves game on May the 19th. And then where would you go? Because he will know, because we all know that Bayern Munich are looking for a manager, and Manchester United might be looking for a manager. Even Chelsea might be looking for a manager. Who knows? But, you know, there's all these different clubs around Europe that could be looking for managers. And I think he tried to be fair to the club. Equally, I think they tried to be fair to him by saying, well, you know, because in the end, otherwise what was going to happen sooner or later was they were going to be making inquiries behind the scenes to agents, to this one, to that one, to that one. Would you be? And at some stage, Klopp's going to get put right on his toes at a press conference or in front of a camera or something like that. You're leaving at the, are you leaving at the end of the season? And then it all comes out like you've been sort of flushed out of your hidey hole, you know, and it's, and it wouldn't have looked right.
Look, it's a lot of things in this because the way Klopp come to the club, and he made everyone introduce themselves to everybody at the football club. All the players had to know everybody's name, and you know that's the way he does things. I think he's so honest to his players, and I think he's been that. Last summer he would have made a number of signings, and they wouldn't have even thought of considering the question of, if I sign for Liverpool and you're the manager and I sign for 5 years, will you be here? Mm. Right? So during the course of the season, when his mind has obviously changed, he's having to look the players in the eyes. And there'd have been players going into his office and talking to him about what's happening, some staying, some going, along the way. That just naturally happens at a football club. Mm. I think he got to the stage where, I've got to tell my players. Mm. Yeah. I've got to tell my players. Just not the outside world, I've got to tell my players first. These are my intentions. I'm leaving at the end of the season, like he said, because he wants to look his players in the eyes and say, look, it'd be worse if he didn't, and then he suddenly departs. And the players are like, where did this come from? And like, he's just left us like this. And I think, I remember I asked that question of Graham Taylor when I joined Villa. I joined in March when it was the old transfer deadline time, you know, the final time to sign players. I asked him, are you taking the England job? He said no in the summer. He said no to me, and I went, okay, because I wanted him to be my manager because he was the one who signed me. So many months later, 3 months later, he took the England job. You know, and I'm saying that because Klopp had a real relationship with his players, and I could see it falling apart. Not as in there'd been loads of bad blood or, you know, bad things going on. I just felt Liverpool in recent weeks, or over a number of games, have just given too many chances away. And I think the loyalty, even having to drop Salah, do things that he would have been uncomfortable doing but felt he had to do it, I think there's a lot going on. We're not inside the 10, so we don't know it all. But what I do know, that he had to tell that dressing room in his mind to make himself and hopefully benefit them and the club. Mm-hmm. I don't think he did anything wrong. It's just the dynamics ended up, the fairy tale ends up most often the nightmare.
Yeah. Do you think it has had any effect, or do you think what actually happened is just that this is realistically where Liverpool have been and that maybe they've been overperforming? Because they could end the season third behind two very good teams. They could have 80-odd points and they could win a trophy, which maybe when we think back to our season previews and looking at this Liverpool team and they've not quite got Jude Bellingham and they've made lots of different signings and how they're going to settle in, that's not a bad season, is it?
Yeah, well, no, they've had a really good season. They've been excited. Look, anyone who's watched Liverpool over the last 8 years, it's been fantastic. They're a joy to watch Liverpool as a team. What I would say that there's been moments in games that I just don't get. Kwanzaa at Man United playing a square ball across the face of the goal. Fernandes gets on one-on-one, they score. You know, an individual mistake, okay. Then I see the goal against, the two goals against West Ham, two headers, 2 6-foot-4 centre-halves, both getting caught in limbo. Mm-hmm. You see the goal against Everton, Calvert-Lewin in the same week. You know, they feel like they're rabbits in the headlights sort of scenarios developed at Liverpool. And there has been a number of mistakes. And I, look, they've had three headers gone in the back of their net. Not from set piece. Well, the Bowen one was from a set piece, but generally in open play. You've got Van Dijk, you've got Konate, you've got Kwanzaa. You've got three big lads to deal with things that are basic. You know, Postecoglou's been criticised for not doing set piece or not getting them right. Liverpool have not been criticised by how many times Antonio edge one's in, Bowen edge one's in, Luke Calvert-Lewin edge one in. You've got these giant centre-halves and they can't manage to stop that. They've got basics wrong in my opinion, and I don't know if it's along the way a lot of things have got lost at Liverpool. Maybe I'm overlooking it.
I wanted to ask you both, because we talked about it on Monday, and obviously the stories have since come out that we think he's going to stay, but Mo Salah, and as we head into this summer where it looks like maybe Arne Slot is going to be the new manager, lots of different changes going to be happening at the club. You've got a player towards the end of his career. I'm not writing off Mo Salah, of course, but I'm just saying there's a summer of change coming. Do you think he should be staying at Liverpool, or should this be a time where Liverpool maybe look to cash in?
No, I think it's time to go. And he's been a fabulous servant for Liverpool, but sometimes you have to make a real cold decision on, have we seen the best football from Mo Salah at his time at the club? The answer is yes. Do I think he's going to get any better or even to the level he was before? No, I don't. I think that's quite clear from the start of whatever reason it is, from the African nations that when he went away in January, he's come back, he's off his game. And there's a little bit of hunger, because the game against Everton was alarming for me, because I said I wouldn't have selected him for that game. He had two left fullbacks against him, Milichenko and Ashley Young. He didn't cause one of them a problem. He didn't, and he looked a little bit disinterested. I think, personally, it's time to move on. Thank him. He's been an amazing servant.
Martin, what do you think about the Mo Salah situation?
I think, I don't, well, I'm not convinced of the reports that he stays. I think that's Liverpool. You know, if Liverpool want to get a low-ball offer from Saudi Arabia, then give the impression that you'd like him to go. So if you want to get a high ball offer from Saudi Arabia,
he's staying.
Keep telling everyone that he's staying, and you want to keep him.
But that's in relation to the stories. Would you agree with Tony that you think it's the right time for him to move?
If you can get the massive offer from Saudi Arabia, then you might be able to do more with it. I think it's a disaster for the league. Because I think Mo Salah is a massively influential.
You still think he's good enough to be, unlike what Tony's saying, you still think he can play at the very top?
Well, I think he can play at the top, but...
I
think he can play. I think it's a disaster for the league more than for Liverpool because of what Mo Salah represents in large parts of the world. And the profile that he gives the Premier League, and the fact that everybody in a large part of the Arabic world, they're all fans of Mo Salah, and you know, he represents them in our league, and that's great for our league. And I think he is a massive loss to the league in that respect, and to the sort of global status of the league. You know, losing individual players, it's all about stars, and losing individual players like that, when La Liga lost Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi, the league took a hit. It's on Viaplay, for God's sake. You know, it was never on Viaplay when they had Messi and Ronaldo. I think it's a hit in that respect. From Liverpool's perspective, if you could get a huge offer from Saudi Arabia that you could do a lot with, yes, it makes absolute business sense for Liverpool. I just think there was a wider issue with Mosan.
Very interesting. Gregor, I wanted to just come back to some of the points Tony made and the question I asked about Liverpool and their season overall. Because again, thinking back to some of our predictions and things, you were in the early stages of the season saying, you know, they've got not lots of problems, but you weren't necessarily convinced of them as title contenders, certainly. So with it,
it's
with
funny.
That...
It was always keeping the ball out of their own net that was my issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then for vast swathes of the season, we were saying, "Crikey, Van Dijk's hitting he's in his best form again. Maybe this could take them to the title." And actually, it's probably been what's been around him. There've been so many times when he's looked in utter despair. Like even that goal that Dominic Calvert-Lewin scored.
Yeah.
It was canny. They blocked him. Yeah. Like if you can block off Van Dijk, who is like a magnet in the box for heading it, you block him off, you've got a chance, and that's what proved to be the case. So, yeah, I think ultimately that has been what has been the Liverpool's downfall. They've scored a lot of goals, not scored as many as Arsenal or City, but they've always had that threat up front, even if they've not been firing, at maximum. If you look at Hamza's piece on the site this week about the kind of game state and how many times they've gone behind, far more than any of the rivals.
Yeah. Which for a long time was the kind of fun, oh, well, Liverpool have conceded, it'll be all right, they'll win 3-1, etc.
But he made the point as well that takes a lot, exerts a lot of energy to be chasing, to try and win points back, never mind, take the lead. So, I think ultimately shipping goals has been what has been their downfall.
And so do we all think that actually, in terms of this reappraising the whole season as a whole and Klopp's final season, that a trophy in third place is a pretty good finish for the team that he's had, the squad that he's had?
I don't think when people say, oh, they've overachieved, I don't think that's true, because I think they're the third best team in the country and they're going to come third. So you'd argue that was par. Winning the Carabao Cup is something that a club of Liverpool's nature might hope to do. So again, that's a good thing.
Should have done better in the Europa League.
Should have done better in the Europa League is what I would say, because you've got to look at that tournament and think, well, Bayer Leverkusen aside, they're the best team in it, and and they'd avoided Bayer Leverkusen. So really the final in Dublin should have been by Leverkusen versus Liverpool, and it's not. So that would be the only part that I would see I don't see it as an underachievement, not finishing in front of Arsenal or Man City, if that's how it ends up, because I think they're both better teams than Liverpool. I think it's an underachievement not being in the final in Dublin, although from UEFA's point of view, it's perhaps for the best, because how that stadium was meant to handle Liverpool versus Bayer Leverkusen, I have no idea.
Tony, final word from you on that idea of Liverpool's season as a whole and Klopp's final season.
Well, it was nearly a fairy tale and ended up a Kushmar, which is a nightmare.
Yeah.
Okay.
God, you were learning so much on this.
I loved his brand of football. I just loved the bravery of...
And he brought through a lot of young players as well.
Yeah, exactly.
This year as
well. Back 2 months, 3 months, we were doing a podcast and we were chatting, the young ones coming in and all these professional footballers' sons and
it's
the world's
basically our
fantastic.
Job to retrofit.
I think it's been a really good joyride that just fell away at the end.
Yeah.
But he's an amazing manager and he has real... You can never accuse Klopp's teams of not running their socks off, even with all their brilliant individual players.
And can you imagine what our league would have looked like without him?
Yeah.
If Liverpool had underachieved even slightly in his time, in the time that Klopp's been the manager, say they had other managers, AN other manager or managers, and they'd underachieved even slightly. Our league would be Manchester City by 15 points every single season. Because the years when Man U have come second to them, it's been 10, 15 points.
Yeah.
Yeah. They haven't been in the race.
Liverpool got 97 points and come second.
Exactly.
Which leads me perfectly onto... Oh, honestly,
guys,
sometimes that was the best.
This show gets suspiciously like journalism. We do try to stay away from it, but,
sometimes we stray into, what the lyrics of American Pie really mean. But sometimes, every now and again, we get it right. Because, Tony, you mentioned that Liverpool team that got 97 points and didn't win the title. And that's what I want to finish on. Some of the best and some of the favourite teams, not necessarily even the best, some of our favourite teams Games, who provided that entertainment that you said, Martin, gave us a proper title race, but didn't win the title. Because it's a subject that I found myself reflecting on after Monday's show, when I challenged Tom Allnutt, Gregor and Alison to talk about who's the best team in the league this season, and they all basically said Arsenal. And I then said, who's going to win the title? And they all said Manchester City. So I do wonder, and Martin, this is something that you've written columns about.
I thought Arsenal were the best team, but I do also believe that the best team wins the league.
Yes, so, absolutely.
You know, if Man City win the league, I'm not going to say Arsenal are the best team.
I do think it's an interesting conversation around Arsenal and how they've improved and how they could end up as a very, very good team who gave us a brilliant title race and finished second. So I just wanted to ask you all about some of your favourite teams from over the years. And obviously one of mine, when I was getting first into football, Keegan's Newcastle. You've got to look back on those title races.
I followed that.
That must have been amazing to watch, wasn't it, Martin?
Yeah, it was. It was great. It was a tremendous team and great fun
I'll love it if we beat them as well. It's one of the all-time
there was
great
that,
moments.
But one of those where you're like, you know, I can remember, I think Fergie had done a piece, was it for the cup final? I think it was for the cup final. The Man on Sunday used to do this, it was a tradition. They always used to get it like this crosstalk piece where they'd get the two managers of the cup final teams.
Their faults, yeah.
You know, and put them together over lunch.
Really?
Amazing.
God, you'd never get that
brilliant,
now, imagine.
Brilliant. And I think it was because there were often teams from the north, and a guy called Bob Cass, who everyone loved, was on the Mail on Sunday, and Cassie could just get people together. One of the people he could always get was Fergie. Fergie was very, very close with Fergie. And I'm trying to remember who the other manager was, but by all accounts, they spend this very long lunch at this golf club or whatever, and you know, there's plenty of red wine flowing or whatever. And then Alex goes home and he turns on his telly and he's sort of half cut sitting there watching the television. And he's suddenly got Keegan straight down the camera. I'd love it if we beat him, and it's a disgrace, like jabbing his finger. And he's sitting there with what might be the last remnants of a glass of red, laughing his head off, thinking, right, we've got this now. So yeah, it was a shame. It was a shame, and it would have been.
But the team was brilliant, wasn't it?
The team was great. Albert, it would have been fantastic for the area. Yeah. I can remember the lap of honour on the last day of the season when it had slipped away from them. Looking at Steve Watson at the back of that group, who was absolutely heartbroken because he was from the area and really knew what it would have meant to him to have won the league. And everyone else was Philippe Albert and people like that waving to the crowd, because in their mind it's a great achievement coming second to Manchester United, but he knew the reality.
That was the team before they bought Shearer.
Which was
the better team, even though they had... Was that a better overall team, more entertaining, even before Shearer came?
I think so, yeah. I think because the way there was... There was a match, and John Beresford going nuts, Keegan going nuts at John Beresford, Beresford going nuts back at Keegan, because David Ginola wasn't covering, wasn't getting back or whatever, and I used to do Kevin's column, and John Beresford's point was that they were basically doubling up on him. I can't remember who they were playing, but they were doubling up on him. And Kevin's point, which seems somewhat unrealistic, was, well, you've just got to work out a way of handling it. You can't, you know, David Ginola never tracks back. And you're thinking, yeah, that's all right in theory, mate, but in reality, that's two versus one, and that's not going. So it's that sort of a team. It was that really cavalier type team.
Maybe that slight tactical acumen was maybe where they fell slightly short. Tony, teams that you've enjoyed that maybe didn't win titles?
Well, I certainly would... top of the list, the 97 points of Liverpool, because that was extraordinary.
I would agree with that. Yeah, that definitely.
Now, to get that many points and come second is extraordinary. I can remember, I was saying to you off air, it was 9 years in a row that Liverpool were either first or second in the early 80s, right through to 90, where they first or second. I can remember Everton having a really good side, really strong physical team. You know, people like Sheedy in it, getting the ball out wide. They'd have... the centre forward,
Graham Sharp
in there, you know, always
Kevin
on
Ratcliffe,
the end, yeah.
Half.
Trevor Stephen. A bit later on, but anyway, they had some really good. Do you know one of my favourite ones though? A very not so light
speed
one.
Left.
I'd go Graham Taylor's Watford. because they were that. You talk about Leicester winning the title. Watford's team at that time was so direct and just getting the ball.
4-2-4.
Yeah, just fighting.
Did they
4-2-4? Played 4-2-4. Yeah.
So now we're going really dinosaur, aren't we?
No, it's not that dinosaur. I've heard of Graham Taylor and Watford.
No, but that would have been about 4-2-4. I think that was about 82. Watford. Yeah, was second, yeah, I think, yeah. Watford.
But, Luther Blissett.
Yeah. You got one, Greg?
I think it kind of gets forgotten too, but Brendan Rodgers' Liverpool side.
Yeah,
scored 101 goals.
Suarez and Sturridge.
2013-14,
The next stage of the SAS.
It's remembered for the slip. But that was a great team. Such fine margins. They kind of lost it at the death. And I think they were top at Christmas. That was a really good team. And with flaws that were kind of... they played John Flanagan at left-back for the whole season. Like, remember him?
Not many people.
But, like, there was, you know... And they played really good football. That was like Brendan Rodgers when he was at his peak, I think.
Yeah.
We could mention Ipswich.
Ipswich we were
certainly
saying,
in the early 80s. With
Bobby Robson. Oh, the two Dutch fellows.
Johnny Walk.
Muir, Tyson.
Yeah. Really good shot.
Alan Brazil.
Yeah. That was Alan still there then? Was he in that team that come second?
I think he was.
Because I'm not sure of that.
Mick Mills right back.
Cool. Blimey. Yeah.
Kevin Beattie.
He was a tough lad.
We should probably as well, some of Arsene Wenger's Arsenal teams, for example, the team that didn't win the title in 99 and of course lost to Manchester United in a semi-final.
That was a good team. The Tottenham team that David Pleat had with Clive Allen scoring the 49 goals, and they just had too many matches at the end. And even though, not in terms of winning the title maybe, but the West Ham team that came third that just ran out of, just had so many matches at the end, 84, 85.
Yeah.
And I was up in Manchester and missed the flipping lot of it.
Having a lovely time up north.
I was at my first national newspaper, the Sunday People, in Manchester. And but that was West Ham's great. And when people talk about McAvaney and Cotty all of that, and I'm thinking... Yeah, but I didn't see any of it really because I was up the other end of the country.
This might be me again retrofitting my memory, but I was only young at the time. But David O'Leary's Leeds were a very exciting team. They didn't actually get all the way. I'm just been checking and actually they've actually tailed off, but got to a Champions League semi-final. But it was a team that
against Valencia
brought a lot of really exciting players through, signed a lot of players,
Gary Kelly, of course,
but they had a lot of really good players.
Yeah, they did. They were a good team. They were a very good team. As Kings claim. Teams that came quite close. I mean, Queen's Park Rangers nearly won the league with Stan Bowles and, in Joey Francis. That QPR team, almost went really close to winning the league. It's Liverpool versus Wolves in the final game of the season that gets played after all the games are finished.
Yeah. I was on trial at that time when they came second. I was on trial at QPR because Theo Foley was the assistant manager.
Oh, of course he was,
He was the assistant manager and I went there. And their reserves, I went to go there and obviously I played a bit with the reserves and I went and watched finishing with the reserves. So I'm standing there and thinking... God, blimey, these are good. They're the same age as me. The finishing was Clive Allen and Paul Goddard.
Was it really?
They were the two up front. I remember thinking, I'll never be as good as them. And I was right. But do you know what I mean? I laugh because I remember standing there thinking, how good are these two at finishing?
What about yourself and your team's tone? Ever in a team that you thought, well, we should have won something?
We came second in 90. I joined late on. I joined in March.
Take credit for that then, can you?
No.
But
we're really close, really close.
Was that like not like in the, you know, in the dressing room?
We was all
like,
gutted.
Yeah.
I mean, I joined obviously, late, so there was people that experienced the whole of the season. I came in March. I was a late transfer and I got two goals in the last 10 games, so I didn't have the sort of impact that
it was your
wanted.
Fault then. What the hell?
No, but I remember the feeling because David Platt, Tony Daly, Gordon Cowans, many others, Nigel Spink were there, and they really felt they had a chance. We won at Derby on my debut. Probably my best game I played for Villa. I had a really good debut. But we had a few indifferent results. We drew at Everton 3-3. I scored at both ends. I scored an own goal and one at the other end.
Which was better?
My own goal was bottom corner, left foot, smashed straight in the bottom corner.
From 30 yards.
It's a free kick. It's a bending free kick coming out, and I've tried to hit it first time, and I've smashed it straight in the bottom corner. It was one of my best finishes.
What were you trying to do? Clear it?
Yeah, try to clear it.
He wasn't trying to kick it into his own net, was he?
But it sounds like it.
But it was one of them, you know, you look, you think, oh, I'm their record signing, I've just buried it in the wrong goal. You know, but yeah. But that was a really honest team.
Yeah.
You know, really good bunch of lads. Graham got the most out of that side.
Yeah.
Brilliant at set pieces. He worked tirelessly on getting everything right, spotting them on free kicks and corners. We worked. I remember thinking, how long the day before a game we're standing on the pitch doing set pieces? Like hour and a half, 2 hours, day before a game.
And you still put one in your own net. Anyway, well, I think that's a fitting way to end a slightly rambling show, but I've enjoyed it nonetheless. The way we started, we did talk about some football along the way. But Tony Cascarino, Martin Samuel, and Gregor Robertson. Thank you.
The show really slightly rambling.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe we should just leave it there. But we'll be back on Monday for more some slightly rambling, I guess.